We have, that's April the 1st, no fooling. It's the Triumph Lecture. Professor David Gross, Nobel laureate in physics, will talk to us on the future of physics, what we don't know. Nice to have somebody talking about what we don't know. On April the 8th, the following week, which is the final lecture of the season, Professor Robert Littman, from the University of Hawaii, will address us on Moses, myth, archaeology, and history. As many of you know, these lectures are free and open to the public. They do cost a little bit to run, and we are very appreciative of those of you who choose to join the Institute. You will have seen the folders outside. Membership is $10 for students, $20 single, $30 for family, and of course, as you know, there's not very much you can do for that kind of price these days for a single event, let alone a whole chain of events. And it does mean if you join that you will get advance notice of what the lectures are. Professor Sheila Jasanoff was born in India. She moved with her family to New York while in her early teens and has spent the rest of her life in the United States. She's Forzheimer Professor of Science and Technology Studies at Harvard University. She's held academic positions at Cornell, Yale, Oxford, and Kyoto. At Cornell, she founded and chaired the Department of Science and Technology Studies. She's been a visiting professor at Cambridge, a fellow at the Berlin Institute for Advanced Study, and resident scholar at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Study Center in Italy. Her research concerns the role of science and technology in the law, politics, and public policy of modern democracies, with a particular focus on the challenges of globalization. She's written and lectured widely on problems of environmental regulation, risk management, and biotechnology in the United States, Europe, and India. Her books include Controlling Chemicals, 1985, The Fifth Branch, 1990, Science at the Bar, 1995, and Designs on Nature in last year. She served on the board of directors of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and is president of the Society for Social Studies of Science. Dr. Jasanoff holds a bachelor's degree in mathematics from Harvard, a master's in linguistics from the University of Bonn in Germany, a PhD in linguistics from Harvard, as well as an advanced law degree from Harvard, and she was admitted to the Massachusetts Bar in 1977. As you might expect, given her background, she's got an extensive list of interestingly titled books, book chapters, journal articles, edited volumes, and reports to her credit. Her Harvard website indicates that she welcomes media inquiries on the following subjects: biotechnology, environment, ethics, Europe, international, non-governmental organizations, politics, regulation, science, and the environment. Now, if any of us were to suggest that we welcomed media inquiries on that, I think most people would be aghast at our effrontery. But if you look at her list of publications, and from what you know now of the kind of life experience she's had, both educational and in publications, I think you'll see that there's nothing at all immodest in those suggestions. In 2004, she wrote a review of a book, which was the book was entitled Science, Truth, and Democracy. Her review was entitled What Inquiring Minds Should Want to Know. What a perfect choice for a speaker at the Vancouver Institute. Please join me in welcoming Professor Jasanoff, who will speak to us on governing life, the comparative politics of biotechnology. And just before I ask you to welcome her, I neglected to say that this is a This lecture is brought to us courtesy of the Cecil and Ida Green Foundation, for which we are profoundly thankful. Professor Jasmine.
Well, John, thank you so much for that introduction. I have to say that whatever my website says about welcoming inquiries, it's not clear that as a member of the Kennedy School, I have any choice whatsoever about declaring those interests. The Kennedy School at Harvard thrives on being the nerve center of the university that is pleased to consider itself the world's greatest, and it would be... Well, modesty is not something that Harvard recognizes as part of its ethos. I hope you'll forgive me for, just living up to the disciplining power of my institution. I think most people in the journalistic community know that they'll, know when to come to me and for what purposes, shall we say. I'm honored to be here and deeply grateful to all of you for coming. And I want to begin this, governing life is a sort of grandiose title, and I recognize that it is so, but the topics that I want to talk to you about tonight are things that meet us and greet us every day in the most commonplace of circumstances. And just to make that clear, I want to begin with an experience that my husband and I had when we spent last semester in Cambridge, UK, with, I think it's a Leverhulme, John, and not a Leverhulme, visiting professorship. But our hosts there had, our hosts there had arranged for us to rent an apartment, or it wasn't an apartment, it was a little row house, and they welcomed us to it by leaving us the ingredients of an English breakfast to have on our first morning there. And part of what they had left us was that, a little box of 6 eggs. And we were first attracted by the incredibly brown color of those eggs. That doesn't show up really in the picture, but they were a rather amazing, rich, rusty color. And it turned out that the reason that they were so specially colored was that they had been very specially nurtured and raised. And inside the lid, you see that there's some text. When you go about the world looking at comparative cultures and public policy, as I do, your attention is always drawn to the texts of everyday life because they give you a lot of information and a lot of insight into the ways in which different societies work. And this one immediately grabbed my attention. And since it's absolutely clear that from wherever you're sitting, you won't be able to read the inside of that text very well, I pulled it out for you. So the company that was purveying these extraordinarily colored eggs was Clarence Court. And inside the lid, it gave us a little bit of an explanation of what we were about to enjoy. So Clarence Court free-range eggs, the lid told us, are special not only for their superior flavor and quality, but because of the poulterer's attention to the health and welfare of his hens, which are free to range and forage on green pasture from dawn to dusk, leading a natural and happy life. And as if that were not quite enough, they went on to tell us further things that our birds enjoy: a generous helping of sun-drenched maize corn in their non-GM vegetarian diet, the privacy of warm, secluded nest boxes, trees and shrubs for cover, dust baths, in fact, everything that a normal, healthy hen requires for its freedom of expression and fullness of life. Well, so we ate those eggs. But if you're working at the borderlines of history of science, philosophy of science, sociology of science, and public policy and politics, you are led to wonder about the status of these objects that you meet just as you roam around the world. And so you're tempted to ask, what are the presuppositions behind this extraordinary text that suddenly swims into your ken? And so what are these chickens like, and what are their eggs? And, you know, my training, as you've heard, is partly in law, and it's in constitutional law, so I wonder about, you know, what an individual is and what gives us rights. And it's interesting to see how the chickens become assimilated to us. So what they like is the same things that we like. What they aspire to is the same things that we aspire to, you know, freedom of expression, fullness of life. We are obligated to them. The poulterer owes them attention, and their health and welfare are part of what we should care about. And in return, they serve our needs. They give us these eggs. And they seem, in some sense, to belong to our moral community. And in fact, if the next time you buy organic food, you look at the packing, you'll find that very often organic foods lay a claim on your attention or your care in these kinds of terms. So they often tell you a personalized story about the way the food was generated and manufactured and how it comes to you. And so it makes itself a part of your form of life, your consciousness, you know, with a kind of ethical claim on where you sit. And it's not any longer just any old object. It's something that belongs in your moral universe in some sense. Well, that's all well and good, but then you read other sorts of texts. And here's one that appeared not that long ago, June 13, 2004, and it's a quotation from a very eminent fertility scientist in the UK working in the Newcastle Research Centre. That is one of the very few places in Britain where somebody actually has a license from British authorities to clone a human embryo for research purposes. At the time that she quoted this, the fertility clinic was known as the Newcastle Centre for Life. Now it's known as the Newcastle Fertility Centre at Life, with the at as an email address. So you can sort of ponder why that should be. But more interesting is this quotation from Professor Murdoch. Out of 10 eggs produced during IVF, IVF is in vitro fertilization, as almost everybody knows by now, treatments, so out of these IVF treatments, on average, 7 are used. The other 3 are spare and would otherwise have been disregarded. We're not trying to clone a baby. These embryos have no more moral status than blood taken from a patient. So here again is a text in which eggs figure, but they're being talked about in very different terms. So these are now human eggs. But when we ask the same sort of question that we asked about the Clarence Court eggs, we see a somewhat different story unfolding before us. So the eggs are produced in a kind of industrial format. They're produced on average, you know, it's a regularized process. They're for use, they're being put to use in certain ways. It's interesting that some of them are spare, and in the British context, you can't help thinking about the heir and the spare of royal succession. And, you know, so it's clear that some of them are going to be used for in vitro fertilization and made into real people, but the other ones are spare. And the embryos that research is going to be done on have no more moral status than blood, and you sort of wonder how the speaker perhaps knows what the moral status of blood is. Anthropologists in this audience will, of course, instantly recognize that blood is one of the most morally laden components of the human body, so it's rather interesting that a British researcher in this century seems to know that it's of lower moral status than certain other things. And what anyway is the moral status of spare embryos? And while the Clarence Court eggs are assimilating themselves to us, in a sense, and laying claim on our moral community, it seems that the IVF embryos produced through cloning are being distanced from our moral community in that text. So we might pose ourselves some questions. How do we know in contemporary societies how to think about eggs? You know, if we just look at evidence that's coming to us from the world outside through newspaper reports or through inside texts of egg boxes, it seems that roles are somehow reversed. I mean, the things that we would expect to have no meaning are being assimilated and laden with meaning, whereas the things we might expect to have more meaning are being somehow distant. So what is an egg? What is an egg? Is it an object? Is it a future life form? And how should we think about embryos? So my research, in a sense, tries to answer these kinds of questions, and it's based on different national cultures. And what I want to show you for the rest of the talk is that by no means are there universal answers to these questions, and I want to think with you a little bit about why not. So to continue the story, and to give you some sense of the cross-cultural differentiation now, I want to show you two different newspaper headlines about a particular story that has a lot of implications for bioethics. So the story in question concerns a woman named Diane Blood, who was the first woman in Britain to want to be inseminated with sperm taken from her husband, who had died in the meantime. So the sperm had been extracted from him before he died and frozen, and he had not given consent because he was already comatose when the sperm got extracted. And so the question became, under British law, was it possible for this woman to be inseminated with sperm from this now dead spouse when he had not given consent? And in the meantime, Britain had enacted a law that said that you had to have the consent of both spouses in order to carry forward this artificial insemination procedure. So the British courts denied Diane Blood's request. She then fought it up the appellate ladder, and eventually she won on the proposition that European human rights law required Britain to allow her to be inseminated, but under British law, it didn't have to happen in Britain. So she then went off to Brussels and on two different occasions was inseminated and bore two children with the sperm from her dead spouse. So this is the Daily Telegraph headline that talks about this legal victory. And what I want you to do is focus on the image of Diane Blood and also to keep in mind what the text says, widow wins fight to bear child of dead husband. The same episode was reported on at the same time in the International Herald Tribune, which of course is an American inflected journal as opposed to the Daily Telegraph, which is, you know, core reading for Britain's newspaper reading public. And look at the picture again, same woman, and look at the text. In UK court case, widow wins right to use spouse's sperm. And now I want to do a little bit of interpretive textual analysis of what these two different sets of headlines are telling us about the kind of claim that Diane Blood has and also the characteristics of the sperm. So first of all, as far as the pictures are concerned, you know, in the one picture, the one the Daily Telegraph uses, we have, if I can just go back to it for a moment, do you see a Christmas tree in the background? And of course, the classic Madonna pose of the woman holding the baby. She's dressed very differently, a dress in one picture, a suit in the other. The appurtenances, the things surrounding her are very different. The baby appears in one picture, not in the other. And then the texts too are very different. So as far as the widow winning, that's something that both newspaper headlines come together on. But what she's winning is represented very differently in the two stories. So in Britain, she wins a fight to bear the child of a dead husband. It's very relational, it's kinship focused. What's being continued here is a family relationship, and that's what she's won the right to continue. In the more American-inflected story, what she's won is a consumerist right to use an object, her dead husband's sperm. And so it's her status as a free consumer entitled to have choice in a market relationship that is being vindicated by the result of the court case. I am, of course, aware about the dangers of overinterpreting text of this sort, especially when it's newspaper headlines. You know, who knows why certain words come into people's heads. But at the same time, there's something characteristically different about the representation of what this woman has gone through and exactly what her victory consists of, depending on whether you look at the more Anglo-cultural way of representing the story or the more American cultural way of representing the same story. And for the next several slides, I want to sort of point out that this isn't actually accidental, that the two headlines in their differences point to some rather systematic differences that one sees as one looks at three different political cultures in which I've looked at the politics of biotechnology, and these are Britain and Germany and the United States. So before we do that, I want to give you a sort of a slight theoretical framework about the ways in which people who are currently thinking about the role of science and technology in contemporary society talk about some of these problems that biotechnology brings to us. So in particular, a very influential thinker in this field is a man named Bruno Latour, who's a sociologist and philosopher of science and technology. And one of the things that he's written about is why modernity, the modern world that we all live in, looks the way it does. And one of the claims he makes is that we in the modern world have become very good at knowing where nature stops and society begins. And he says, well, if you actually look at anything out there, anything you can think of, whether it's the ozone hole or Clarence Court eggs or embryos produced through in vitro fertilization, the world is actually very messy. It's very difficult to say where nature stops and where society begins. It's all a huge mishmash. Nevertheless, in going about the world, we sort of know where to put things. We know which things belong in nature. Everybody here would say the ozone hole, well, that's a natural phenomenon. Never mind that it's the product of chemicals that we used in part to allow our hairsprays to come out better out of cans and so on and so forth. We don't think about all that social baggage when we start classifying things. So Latour argues that one reason that modernity seems to make sense and look as orderly as it does is that we have developed a capacity to take very complicated relationships and simplify them so we always know where nature ends and where society begins. Well, if this is true, then it should be particularly true in the case of biotechnology, because biotechnology is all about confusing that line between nature and culture, in a sense, because we're constantly producing new things through biotechnology that challenge those classifications. And so if you think of nature as consisting of the stuff of the natural world and culture as consisting of all the things that we think of as society, you find that products of biotechnology are often seen as crossing taboo lines. And you see this partly in the kinds of linguistic terms we've invented for them, like frankenfoods. You know, these what is a food anyway? But franken gives it this sort of air of illegitimacy and the kind of dread that the story of Frankenstein, the myth of Frankenstein, evokes to this very day. Terminator genes, this was a kind of innovation that Monsanto was thinking of for a while in plant or agricultural biotechnology. And partly this innovation was shut down, at least for a time, because people took the name of a film, the Terminator films, and attached it to this gene that was going to bring about infertility in the plants. How do we think of something like Diane Blood's case? I mean, you know, at some level, you could think of it as necrophilia. I mean, you know, a desire to procreate with somebody who is no longer alive. But of course, that's not how we think about it in practice. We know that the Daily Telegraph believes that it was a right to bear the child of the dead husband. That's obviously not considered to have the kind of dread and you know, taboo association that we put together with necrophilia, and similarly with ideas like clones and pre-embryos and surrogate mothers. I mean, we seem to know somehow in society what to do with all of these categories, whether we accept them or don't accept them. Now, Latour's diagrams in a way, are rather simplified because they assume that there's a single kind of modernity in which we go about doing things the same way. And what I'd like to suggest is that that's an overly pared-down understanding of the way that our worlds are currently working. So culture and history are not present in this idea of purifying the hybrids into nature and culture. And we might ask, well, we live in the modern world, but is there a single modern world, or are there many? Secondly, that kind of analysis of the world says very little about who is actually doing the work of purification. I mean, maybe something like this reclassification is going on, but who is bringing about the particular classifications around us? Is it industry? Is it government? Is it society? Is it culture? You know, where do we locate it? How, in practice, are these simplifications happening? For instance, is law implicated? Is it the market? Are scientists doing it? You know, so what are the mechanisms? And lastly, should we care? I mean, if people are doing these things differently, should it matter to us, you know, which kind of purification, if you will, is the best one? So these are all things that we might want to think about, and the best way to think about it is actually to look around the world and see whether there are differences and what we think of them. So a good starting point for all of this kind of inquiry is to go back to thinking about abortion, not only because it's such a politically salient issue, particularly south of the border for you, fortunately, within my borders for me, unfortunately, but it's the politics of abortion is a starting point for thinking about many of the kinds of cross-national differentiations that are cropping up around questions like stem cells and, of course, also technologically assisted reproduction. And we find if we look at an issue like this that is in the newspapers all the time, the approaches that the United States, Britain, and Germany have taken, in spite of the fact that these are three very similar societies, that the approaches and answers are radically different. So in the US, as of now anyway, women are entitled to have an abortion, certainly through the first trimester and perhaps beyond to some extent, and a woman's absolute right to an abortion cannot be completely denied, although the state can put reasonable restrictions on it. And what the woman's right to abortion is traded off against is the state's interest in protecting developing life of all of its citizens. In Britain, the language used is never that of rights. I mean, of course, Britain has an unwritten constitution, as you all know, and so there is no rights talk in the way that we have it in the American context. So whether a woman can have an abortion or not is, I mean, the answer in Britain is quite liberal, but it's a matter of medical judgment and it has to be reached on medical advice. And what the doctors are required to take account of is the maternal state of health and the mother's welfare and what the sort of total social implications of abortion will be. In Germany, there's no question under law that the embryo is entitled to full human dignity, which is an absolute guarantee under the German constitution. But nevertheless, it turns out that abortions are fairly liberally available because the mother too has certain rights, and they include personal autonomy, which in Germany is interpreted to mean that a woman is entitled to the full unfolding of her personality, and so that can't be curtailed in the interests of allowing the development of the human embryo. It's actually a criminal offense in Germany to abort a fetus, but in fact, if you get medical permission, then you can conduct an abortion without being at risk of that criminal penalty. So it's an oddly bifurcated law. I mean, unlike in the US, unlike in Britain, it is by law a criminal offense to carry out an abortion, and yet there's a very liberal set of exemptions provided you can get medical justification for carrying out the abortion. So what I want to point out is that the fact, you know, although the end result is that first trimester abortions are fairly liberally available in all three countries, the grounding for that decision is radically different in these three societies. That in turn relates to the politics of technologically assisted reproduction, like in vitro fertilization. So in America, there's no national, in the United States, there's no national regulation of this. It happens state by state, and in many states it's not regulated at all, so fertility clinics can decide what sort of policies they'll adopt. So for instance, on something like, can you have selective abortions for purposes of sex selection, or can you have diagnostic tests that will allow you to determine the sex of your baby so that then you can choose to have a selective abortion? That's something that's often decided by policy in reproductive clinics and not by national law. In Britain, by total contrast, all of these areas are regulated by national law, a single law, and there is a single agency in charge of it, the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority. And in Germany, equally, there is a national law regulating these issues, and very many of the kinds of complexities that we saw in the Diane Blood case are simply ruled out by law, because German law about in vitro fertilization is the most restrictive of the three societies I'm talking about. Not surprisingly, then, the moral status of this object, the embryo, comes out looking very different in the three countries. So biologically, that's the kind of entity we're talking about on day four, but what do we actually call it? In America, there's no fixed term for this. The term pre-embryo is used, but exactly what is going to get called a pre-embryo differs. It differs according to state-by-state court decisions, according to private contractual agreements that people reach, according to the practices of different reproductive clinics. By contrast, in the UK, the pre-embryo is defined to be the embryo before 14 days of development, and the term pre-embryo has recently been construed to include not only embryos generated through sexual reproduction and the union of two gametes, but also artificially produced embryos through the kind of cloning procedure that led to the production of the sheep Dolly that many of you will have heard of. In Germany, the whole category of the pre-embryo is not supposed to come into being, because one of the things that the law does is tell you that you're not supposed to create any embryos that are not immediately implanted into the womb of the woman who's undergoing the fertility treatment. Nevertheless, some of these embryos come into being, and you know, in question and answer period, I'd be happy to go into more detail if anybody wants. But there are very, very few of these things in Germany, because they're prevented by law from coming into being. So whereas in America, there's a population of perhaps close to 500,000 frozen embryos that are produced through in vitro fertilization, these are the spares that Alison Murdoch was talking about in the quote I gave you before. In Germany, that number is vastly less, and it's something on the order of, you know, between 0 and 3,000 by best counts. And these are known as spare embryos, supernumeraries. So how is it that Britain, of these three modern societies, and indeed of many others as well, that Britain is the only one that has been able to draw a sharp line and say pre-embryo is up to 14 days, and after that it becomes an embryo and becomes entitled to respect as a fully developing potential human being? So, I mean, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, everybody knows what the biological entity is. It's the same developmental biology, whether you're in Germany or Britain or Canada or the US. So why is it that only Britain, as a matter of national policy, is able to say 14 days marks a difference in developmental biology? I mean, nobody else has achieved that kind of result. And this is why I call it metaphysics, because really what this entity is understood as being is different in the societies that I'm talking about. So to look at that, one of the interesting places where one can look is legislative debates, because after all, it's the law that ends up declaring how to think of this entity, the 14-day-old embryo before it's, you know, developed into embryonic status, or the status of a full embryo. So in Britain, a lot of the ethical work that is relied upon in the law was done by a particular committee headed by a moral philosopher trained at Oxford named Mary Warnock. And she then went on to become the mistress of Girton College in Cambridge, but also a member of the House of Lords, so she became Baroness Warnock, in part because of the kind of work that she had accomplished in this ethics committee, the Warnock Committee in Britain. Nevertheless, although the committee had done this metaphysical work and this ethical work, it was a very controversial report that they produced back in 1984, and it took Britain 6 years to enact their recommendations into law. And it seemed for a while that Parliament, the House of Commons, was actually going to vote down the government's proposal for legislation. So the government, in order to avoid that result, went to the House of Lords, and there they had a debate about what to do with the Warnock Commission's recommendations. And the recommendations included this idea that research should be permissible up to 14 days, but after 14 days, it should be very strictly regulated and no more research. So I was curious what Mary Warnock herself had to say about this 14-day dividing line. You know, why did she believe, you know, unlike philosophers in any other country, that there could be such a sharp line? And this is the way in which she talked about it in the House of Lords. So there's a very noble prayer frequently uttered in my college chapel, and she means Girton College, that we may be given the grace to distinguish things that differ. So she's calling upon divine grace to allow her to see something, but to see something that's there in nature. I mean, so things that differ. So we can't see this with unaided sight, and yet it is there to be seen. It's something in nature, but we need God's grace to see it. I, as a member of my college chapel, pray this most fervently because I believe that it is our moral duty to make a distinction in this case between the pre-embryo and the embryo, which is to become the individual, and to act on this distinction. So, you know, it's a very interesting moment in which a metaphysical distinction is being made in the House of Lords on the basis of divine grace as, you know, called upon in Girton College. So I was interested in where this divine grace itself stemmed from, and it seems that it comes from this particular prayer of Thomas à Kempis, which I gather was and still is frequently used as a prayer in Girton College. And you'll see there that what Thomas is asking for is for God's eye to look through him so that judgments of right and wrong, moral correctness or not, get taken away from him, the praying human being, and, you know, become one with divine understandings of right and wrong. So grant me, O Lord, to know what is worth knowing, to love what is worth loving, to praise what delights you most, to value what is precious in your sight, to hate what is offensive to you. But then this is the philosophically interesting bit. Do not let me judge by what I see, nor pass sentence according to what I hear, but to judge rightly between things that differ, and above all, to search out and do what pleases you through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. So, of course, this prayer is about judging rightly between what is morally right and what is morally wrong. But in Baroness Warnock's statement of it, what is morally right and what is morally wrong gets mapped onto what is epistemologically right and wrong in some sense. So she wants to be able to see biology in terms of rightness and wrongness. And in this moment, you get a coming together of religiously inspired moral understandings of rightness and wrongness and, you know, a scientific sort of line drawing within biology between the 14-day embryo and the embryo that develops after that point. So in the United States, of course, we don't have an institution like the House of Lords, and we don't have civil servants or people who are authorized to speak for the nation in the way that a baroness in the House of Lords, who is at the same time mistress of Girton and one of the nation's most eminent moral philosophers, has. We just don't have the institutions in the US that can do that sort of thing. And that, I think, makes a huge difference when one comes to something like the politics of embryonic stem cells, which is one of the hottest issues in the biomedical sciences today. And there again, one sees country by country differences on that kind of question. So in America, stem cells have become the battleground between right to life and pro-choice groups, as in the case of abortion. And so the national government is stymied from making any kind of public policy in this area, or very cautious policy in any case. The Bush government basically chose in 2001 to adopt a policy of virtually no federal funding for stem cell research and has maintained that position ever since. So what one sees instead are state-by-state initiatives that go around whatever barriers the federal government has set up, and my own university has a stem cell initiative that's privately funded. In Britain, on the other hand, because the national government, through the kinds of mechanisms that I showed you, was able to draw this line, there's more or less free-flowing research before the 14 days and regulated research or no research after that point. In Germany, even the production of stem cells is banned for the kinds of reasons that I talked about before, because it violates the German idea of the absolute dignity of human life. And so the German debate has been about when is it okay to even import stem cells into the country. And what Germans have been very caught up with is if they decide on moral grounds that they should not be manufacturing these stem cells, will not they be violating their own morals by importing ethically inappropriate stem cells from somewhere before? So the resolution they reached in 2002 was that it was okay to import stem cells created before that date, because up to that point, they didn't have their own ethical requirements in place, but not to import stem cells that were manufactured after the strict cutoff date posited in the...
Sorry?
The pre-14-day embryo is treated differently. That's the only point I'm making with that. You may think that all of this is really based on human biotechnology, but it's an interesting fact that these same sort of cross-cultural differences appear even if one is looking at genetically modified crops. I mean, so the differences bleed into the area of agricultural biotechnology as well. And what one sees in the American case is that there's been very little debate about the legitimacy of genetically engineering crops. And the only place where there has been wide debate about the risks of genetic engineering have been in connection with organics labeling. So there was a sort of huge conflict over whether genetically modified crops could be labeled organic or not. And it's the one area in which the U.S. deviated from its basic policy that it treats genetic modification the same as any other kind of technology. And organics are the only sort of area of agricultural crop and food production where you cannot get an organics label if genetic modification is in the background or is part of the production process. In Britain, where there's been very little sort of overt political upheaval over questions like abortion or technologically assisted reproduction, you've had massive mobilization over the question of genetically modified crops, and very special political steps have been undertaken in Britain to try to calm public unrest and public anxiety about these issues. But as a result, the ecological uncertainties of genetic modification in agriculture have been debated much more extensively in Britain than in the US. In Germany, most of the attention in law and policy has been devoted not so much to floating the scientific uncertainties, but to making sure that genetic modification and non-genetic modification can be kept apart as well as possible. So the Germans were the first to introduce a strict labeling law. They're also the people who've gone furthest in insisting that the coexistence of genetically modified and non-genetically modified crops should be supported through very strict policy requirements on the part of GM growers. All right, so these are country-by-country differences on very specific issues, and I think one can, to some extent, generalize them to make some generic statements about, you know, what these countries allow or not. And I'm using the term monster in sort of the sense in which Bruno Latour's diagrams that I showed you before talk about monsters. I mean, so the monsters are the things that we don't know where to put. We don't know whether they belong in nature or culture or in some indeterminate gray zone. And we find that as a strategic matter, the US is perfectly happy to let border crossing entities come into being. So one of my favorite stories about this is that America is the place where a child was born who potentially had claims on six different adults for some kind of parental support, but had to go to court to get any parent at all. How did this come about? Well, a couple wanted to have a child. They couldn't have it evidently by normal means, so they went to sperm and egg banks and got an egg from an anonymous donor and sperm from an anonymous donor. Then they had the IVF embryo be carried to term by a surrogate mother who also had a husband. But by the time the baby was born, the original couple had split up. 9 months is a long time. Neither of them wanted to have the burden of this child. The surrogate mother obviously didn't want to have the burden of the child because she had only contracted for the 9 months. The surrogate mother's husband was even further out of it, and the anonymous sperm donor and egg donor had no particular responsibilities to having the progeny from their sperm and egg, you know, lay claims on them in this sort of fashion. In the UK and in Germany, this situation could not come about, and that's the important point. That in America, we have lawsuits to sort out after the fact what happens, but there's a prior set of laws and regulations in place in the other two societies so that the situation doesn't come about. In the UK, in theory, it could, but it has to happen under strict regulation, and there is a central authority, as I've said already, that regulates. The shadowy categories that straddle boundaries are not allowed to come into being at all, whether they're crops, in which case they must be kept separate from each other, or embryos, in which case they're just not supposed to be there at all. And I think that all of this ties in with who is doing the regulation of innovation in these different societies. So in America, we have, of course, the strong commitment to the idea that the market regulates which innovations are allowed to come into being and which ones can go forward, whereas in Britain, there's far more of a sense that expertise should regulate the development even within the marketplace, and in Germany, that all innovation has to occur in a space that is already firmly regulated by law. And all of this fits in with where the normative ideas are put in place. So in America, as we've seen, the state-by-state approach to stem cells corresponds to a far more general notion that norms can be decentralized. They don't all happen to have, you know, the same source. You don't have to have national unity on these kinds of problems, whereas both the UK and Germany are in favor of much more centralized resolution of value disputes. And the way in which you actually resolve disputes also differs in these societies. So in America, through litigation, you get winner-take-all resolutions. So whoever is the party in power can dictate what national bioethics will look like, at least for their term in office, and then there might be a change afterwards. In Britain, it's far more consensual, so that a baroness in the House of Lords can claim divine grace to speak for the country and ends up, in fact, speaking for the country. In Germany, you have to give reasons much more a rational, reason-based approach to making these kinds of decisions. And the ultimate authority to whom people are accountable for making public choices also varies. So in America, it's very much the courts at the end of the day. In Britain and Germany, it's the legislature. But in Britain, there's a lot of delegation by the legislature to administrative authorities like the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority. Well, just to finish up then, what should we conclude from this kind of comparative overview of what is happening with the politics of biotechnology in our time and you know, in around these issues that we read about in the newspapers every day? So what I've been arguing is that different cultures really come, you know, to these questions about what to do about the ethics, morality, practicality of different developments in biotechnology with very different views of what kinds of things are at stake. Is it a matter of women's rights? Is it a matter of the absolute dignity of the potential human from the moment of fusion of the nuclei of the two gametes? You know, what is it that we're really worrying about? The three countries I've been talking about are all democracies, but as we've seen, democracies don't necessarily answer these questions about innovation in science and technology in the same way. So in some, you know, quite meaningful sense, we can say that where developments in science and technology are concerned, there's not one democratic solution, but more than one to the ways in which we deal with the problems of contemporary biotechnology and bioethics. And then, as I hope I've indicated, what ethical principles we derive for moving around with our capacity to innovate really differs depending on, you know, what the primary mechanism is through which we hope to answer these kinds of questions. So in a market-based society like the United States, you come up with different sorts of answers to problems from a society like Germany, where law is seen as very importantly standing in the background and framing the kinds of issues that we're talking about. I said that one of the things that we need to think about more, at least, is what should we prefer? From the beginning of my own immersion in comparative studies, which is by now more than 25 years old, whenever I give a talk on comparison, people want to say, well, who does it better? And for a long time, I said, you know, don't you understand what I'm saying? It's not a question of straight better or worse on a linear scale. You know, people do it differently. But it turns out that people really deeply want to know who does it better. And I'm still not prepared to say, you know, this country does it better and that country does it worse. But I am prepared to say something about what kinds of trade-offs are at stake and what kinds of choices we should focus on to think a little more clearly about this issue of better or worse. So first of all, there is a sort of assumption abroad in the world that science and technology move around by themselves, that innovation happens and discovery happens because people figure out how to do things better. And that our choices of how to innovate in science and technology are, in some sense, value neutral. And what I've been trying to suggest is that they're actually far from value neutral. A British governmental decision that they want to pour a great deal of money into fertility-related research, but in relation to that, also things like stem cells and embryonic stem cells in particular, and cloning, these are not value-neutral choices. They rest on deep underlying notions about what is appropriate or not, where human life begins or not, and so on and so forth. So the kinds of policy choices we make about science and technology are profoundly not value neutral, and they relate to what kinds of societies we want to live in and what kinds of connections we want to have among each other as human beings as well. In some sense, in the three countries that I look at, Germany and the US represent opposite poles on several dimensions, and it's worth pointing out what some of these dimensions are. So on the question of whether the ethical choices and judgments ought to be made by individuals or by the group, society as a whole, Germany on the whole opts for the collective decision-making and the US for the individualized decision-making. On the question of whether values for society ought to be centralized and applicable to all of society in the same way, as opposed to decentralized and depending a lot on where you sit in particular, Germany favors the centralized approach, a single law for the entire country. The US favors the decentralized approach. If you live in Massachusetts, you can do a whole lot of things, including engage, for instance, in same-sex marriages that you're not allowed to do in Texas. And if you're in Massachusetts, there's no death penalty. And if you're in Texas, there is. In some sense, Americans don't feel peculiar about living in a society or in a nation that has these radical differentiations. They would not be tolerable or tolerated if one were in Germany. On the question of reasoning, German public policy depends very centrally on reasons being given and those reasons being arrived at collectively as well. Whereas on the American side, it seems much more that we tolerate experimentation to see what kinds of possibilities may exist, and only after the fact, if a dispute arises, will people then go to law or go to the courts to seek a resolution of these differences. So the idea that novel technology is something to incorporate into your life, into your social life, and for it to become part of an experimental way of living is somehow inconsistent with a German desire for rationality and order, and in America we don't seem to have that desire for rationality and order in the same way or to the same extent. So in thinking about what do we prefer, and I haven't been talking about Canada, of course, although I do have some ideas about some of the kinds of solutions that you've come up with in some of these areas, I think rather than asking who does it better or who does it worse, it may be more productive to go back and ask, well, which of these different approaches do we favor? I mean, do we favor the collective solution? And if so, what do we mean by collective? Do we favor a single resolution for the entire country, or do we want to tolerate localized differences? In the United States, it's very commonplace to say sometimes that the 50 United States are 50 different laboratories, which speaks to a notion of a tolerance of social experimentation as a form of life. But there are times and places where you may not want all of these labs to be experimenting in totally different ways. So, you know, it's a set of trade-offs, and again, one can ask about that. And then about reasoning. I mean, do we want ideally to produce people whom we see as trustworthy reasoners, as we do in the case of Supreme Court justices for the most part, both in Canada and in the United States, and then let them come to choices? Or at a time when the Supreme Court is intensely politicized, as it is in the United States at this point, do we want a more society-wide discussion of the reasons and rationales for going forward, as is commonplace in Germany whenever any new kind of public policy approach is undertaken? So I'm not going to answer the questions, but I suggest that, interestingly, even in highly technical areas of production and public policy, as those surrounding biotechnology, these three democracies, which have so much in common, they're all constitutional democracies, incredibly well-educated, wealthy, committed to a rights-based regime for the individual, market-oriented economies, that there are very fundamental differences about how to go forward with technological innovation, and that these are choices that are not limited to any one democracy, and they're choices that it bears our thinking about together, probably for a long time to come. So let me stop there. Yes, back there.
I have a question about the provenance of the photograph.
Could you just repeat what your question about the pictures is?
Well, where did they come from? Who took the photo that appeared in your American store? You know, what were the circumstances in which those photographs were taken?
Yeah, well, I mean, as far as the pictures are concerned, I can't really tell you very much. I mean, they're staff, you know, photographers for these journals, so the point is, the point of those pictures is to give a sort of graphic illustration that different interpretations can be put on the same story, and they have been. Obviously, if you were doing media analysis, you could go back and sort of, you know, try to get a more systematic understanding of, you know, whether lawsuits are always reported in the same sort of way in the International Herald Tribune as opposed to the Daily Telegraph and so on and so forth. That's not my sort of research, and I'm using those as illustrative of more deep-seated differentiations between these two cultures. So take them as signals rather than as, you know, data points in a larger data set. In terms of globalization of research, I mean, globalization is a very interesting word because nobody knows exactly what it means. Certainly, if it means that researchers can freely travel from country to country and results are sort of equally available and applicable everywhere, that's not the case. I mean, so in some, you know, fairly serious sense, research is not globalized. And certainly, if you look at something like the debates that have arisen around the Korean stem cell research and the discovery of fraud in that lab, it turns out that, I mean, this is Dr. Huang, who published a couple of major articles in Science magazine, which at one level suggests that research is globalized because, look, here is somebody doing stem cell research in South Korea and can have access to premier scientific journals in the United States, and that then affects research policies of other people in different places. But it, you know, once the thing blows up, it turns out that Science magazine can't possibly do the same kind of peer review of research that's happening off in Korea. I mean, this I know actually from talking to the editor of Science magazine and other people who are very closely involved with the process. So it turns out that you can't possibly interpret things like, you know, what was the internal relationship between Dr. Huang and his co-workers, and was there coercion involved and something like that, because you're relying on a set of statements. Apparently there were linguistic problems. I mean, so, you know, when the referees in America were asking certain kinds of questions, it was not clear whether the Korean answers meant the things that the English speakers in America understood and so on. So, you know, one has to take that notion of globalization with a few grains of salt. And it also turns out that in spite of the fears that are often expressed about how, you know, relatively lax regulation in one society or another will enable people to go ahead, you know, all the faster there, and therefore there'll be a brain drain. I mean, like zillions of American stem cell researchers will flee to the UK because it's a more hospitable research environment. That sort of thing tends not to happen. I mean, the startup costs, the infrastructure, the sunk costs of doing research in particular places, the networks of relationships, these are all too stable to produce that kind of easy globalization. So that's, you know.
Thanks very much.
Yes. The question is Canada's place on those axes. You know, I'm not an expert in Canadian politics, so I couldn't really, you know, talk about it in detail. But, you know, like us, like the US, you're a federal system which, of necessity, for reasons that are different from the US, has to tolerate a certain amount of diversity, at least between the Francophone and the Anglophone parts of the country. And so there can't be the same sort of insistence on sameness across the country that you find in Germany. At the same time, of course, you've gone through a very recent, relatively recent in historical terms, adoption of a written constitution and a written set of rights, which in a way puts the interpretation of textual language and the law in a different position in Canada from where it is in the US. And this has already led to some sort of interesting differences in biotechnology as far as legal interpretation is concerned. And probably the most interesting case from my point of view is the intellectual property decision that the Canadian Supreme Court reached on the case of the so-called Harvard oncomouse. I mean, so this is whether the mouse that was genetically engineered first at Harvard to be sensitive to cancer so that it would develop cancer more quickly and could be used, therefore, in testing for carcinogens, whether that mouse could be patented or not. Now, under American law, as interpreted back in 1980, there's no question that it can be. Under Canadian law, as interpreted more than 20 years later, that higher organism cannot be patented. And what makes the case interesting is that the legal language is virtually identical. So it's almost the same patent law as far as the wording is concerned, but the Canadian decision is vastly different. And I think that that has to do with the type of reasoning and the type of tradition of legal interpretation and how it ties in with metaphysical considerations. I mean, the Canadian court engages in a kind of reasoning about the ethics of life and the way in which research impinges on the meaning of life. The US Supreme Court was given that issue in the Friends of the Court brief that were given to the court, but the Supreme Court said that would be talking about politics, and that's the role of the legislature. So we don't want to take on board such questions as, will biotechnology have a reductionist effect on the meaning of life? The Canadian court was not shy about going there. So the line between where, you know, the sort of technicality of the law ends and ethics takes up is actually differently understood in the Canadian setting. Yeah, back there. So are you asking about a comment on the connection between the laissez-faire market approach and the...
There seems to be a sort of a fundamental conflict for the right there on this issue between business free to do what it should do to be profitable and the Christian values, I guess, that they hold. And I just wonder
Yeah, so the question is there a conflict between the Republicans' traditional friendliness to laissez-faire capitalism and the apparent allegiance of the Republicans to the Christian right at the moment? Well, you know, first of all, it's not entirely obvious when one looks at questions like the Alaska pipeline that the Christian right is running the country on all possible issues. I mean, there are plenty of places where current administrative policies favor, you know, industrial and capitalist interests in a perfectly straightforward way on all environmental matters, for instance. That is the case. Secondly, I think that, you know, one has to understand the operation of market sensibility in America in, you know, not only in terms of whether public policy favors a particular interest group or a set of interests on market-related concerns, but also, you know, about politics itself being a kind of market. So the Christian right's centrality in American political thinking or the thinking of the Republican Party at the moment can itself be seen as a kind of market decision. So for a long time, you know, at least 20, 30 years of the post-Eisenhower period and reaching into the Reagan period. The dogma in the US was that you couldn't put a winning coalition together, a very market type of idea, by going to the extremes, that you had to build it from the middle. So that's the dogma that was challenged by the current Bush administration and by Karl Rove. So the strategy now is to put together a winning coalition by taking the far right and the middle right and putting them together. Well, there are tensions that have begun to develop, but they're not entirely or only or even primarily because business interests are feeling starved in some way. I mean, after all, the main opposition to the positions on stem cell research have come from quarters of the political coalition that are not voting for George Bush anyway. I mean, there is some fracturing in Republican ranks, but California with its stem cell initiative has not been voting Republican in national elections anyway. So it's not clear whether the kinds of positions that the Bush administration is taking on science and technology issues are fracturing that Republican coalition as of yet. Yes.
If you go to the philosophy department at your August institution, do they take any attention to these sort of issues? Is this are any of these a hot topic within philosophers today?
Do philosophers at my August institution, although I suspect you could take any, pay any attention to these issues? Yes, well, of course they pay attention to these issues. Bioethics is quite a hot topic in philosophy departments these days. Do they pay attention to bioethics as a political issue? Probably not. That is, I think most philosophy departments around the country are still thinking of bioethics largely in terms of what principles should govern relationships between individuals and maybe the medical establishment, or individuals and maybe the research establishment. A lot of my kind of analysis would be seen possibly as ethical relativism by philosophers, because they would see me as arguing for the position that different societies have different ethical understandings. Of course, that's not precisely what I'm saying. I'm saying that historically and culturally, different societies in different countries frame the value issues in different sorts of ways. And we can give historical explanations for why in Germany this idea of human dignity should be understood in a particular way and given so much pride of place, just to take one example. And I don't think that kind of subtlety or that kind of variation and the role of history and culture are things that philosophers, you know, readily take into account. And who's that?
Given your analysis, it seems that you've illustrated very effectively that there is different underlying social and cultural assumptions in each of these policy contexts. So I was wondering whether you could extrapolate that to the scientific context and show that these differences in policy are actually having an influence on the way that science
So can I show that these kinds of cross-cultural differences that I've talked about are having an impact on the kinds of science being done and the kinds of conclusions that are being reached in the sciences? Well, I mean, at one level, in terms of tracing research trajectories and areas of emphasis, it's not hard to show that. So Germany, for instance, with its very restrictive anti-experimental, almost, approach to biotechnology, which it has only just recently, in the last 5 or 6 years, begun to break out of. Germany is not a leader in most areas of biotech. America, with its far greater receptivity to experimentalism, is the leader among my three countries on agricultural biotechnology, where regulation has been the least restrictive, the most open-ended. and on areas of reproductive biology, stem cell research, and cloning in particular, Britain has scored successes with its more sort of laissez-faire approach to scientific development. I thought you were going to ask something that goes back to the globalization point, though. I mean, about whether scientists themselves are subject to these kinds of cultural influences, or whether scientists rise, you know, above it through some universal allegiance to a scientific ethic, which is not culture specific. And there I would say that, you know, it's again not exactly my research area, because I work much more on public policy framings and reasoning in that area. But I do think that scientists operate within culture, and that they're not as, you know, sort of universal a band of practitioners, you know, believing in a single scientific ethos regardless of where they sit. I think that something like the statement I quoted from Alison Murdoch, a leading scientist in Britain, about eggs being spares and, you know, no more moral status and so on, that kind of statement you would expect not to see from an American scientist, who would be much more sensitive to the resonances of, you know, public debate and morality about these issues in that country. One more. Well, I haven't asked anybody on this side, so. Yeah, the question is about whether I can comment on the rise of public participation processes in the three countries and whether they're having an impact on public policy in the three countries. If I did justice to that question, we'd probably be here for at least as much longer. Yes, of course, I can say something about that. The political mobilization has been actually quite different and in some ways unpredictable in the three countries that I'm talking about. So one of the things that people really notice about the United States in relation to agricultural biotechnology is that although we were the first to mobilize on many environmental issues in the 1970s and were actually leaders in setting the legal template for assessing many kinds of environmental problems, in recent years, we seem to have fallen silent, and there's been very little public upheaval, controversy, questioning, participatory demand, ecological concern even expressed by the public about ag biotech. So it wouldn't actually fit to say that there is a rise in participatory fervor in science and technology issues in the US, certainly not about agricultural biotechnology. And even on stem cells, the mobilization is not exactly national. It's very sort of case specific and more coming from the scientific community than from the public at large in some sense. I mean, if you're doing cross-national research between Europe and the US, actually one of the striking differences is that in Europe today, there's a lot of political fervor or ferment around science and technology, and not in America. And the implications of that for research and for policy have been actually quite striking. I mean, so one can see that many areas of uncertainty have been opened up first in countries other than the US. And when they have been opened up in the US, it's been almost by happenstance. So this famous experiment that was done at Cornell to show that pollen from genetically modified corn, when fed to caterpillars feeding on milkweed, monarch butterfly caterpillars, that it brought about, you know, 50% death in the population of these caterpillars. There's a question why that kind of ecological research was not done before these things were, you know, widely used in the environment. And interestingly, in Britain, a whole sort of level of scale-up studies got done, the farm-scale trials, in response to uncertainties that the British public expressed as a result of these participatory mechanisms. So, I mean, this, you know, again, relates to the sort of implications of these political culture differences for the conduct of science itself. On the whole, interestingly, the country that has the least tradition of public mobilization, namely Britain, has innovated strikingly in some participatory mechanisms in the recent past. I mean, that's something that I'll just leave hanging because it's too deep a question to try to get into why. But as far as the impact of these participatory mechanisms is concerned, Germany has enormous participation up to the point of enacting law, and then everything falls silent, as if law, once the rules are in place, that governs the entire territory with sufficient reason, and then you don't have to ask questions about participation. So on the whole, scientific uncertainty tends to be deliberated more in the Anglophone countries, less in Germany. So there are these kinds of quite far-ranging impacts on the relationship between the participatory mechanisms, when they're instituted, how they tie into the legislative process, and the kinds of questions that we're asking about science, and the kinds of uncertainties that we're expressing about science and technology.
I'd now like to call on Professor Milan Kandlikar of the Institute of Asia Research and the Liu Institute, a sometime student of Professor Jasinov, to thank our speaker.
Thank you. It's not often that we get a chance to hear a speaker who ranks among the founders of a new field of inquiry in the social sciences. Over the past three decades, the field of science and technology studies has made an invaluable contribution to our understanding of the relationship between science and society. Today's talk by Dr. Jasinov demonstrated why she's considered to be a luminary in the field of science and technology studies. Thank you, Dr. Jasinov, for your stimulating and enlightening talk on an issue that, whether we like it or not, has a profound influence on all of our lives. As Dr. Jasinov's talk showed, the story of the emergence of new technologies is complex and infused with the culture and politics of individual societies. What may be seen as natural in one society is seen as artificial or unnatural in another. What may be safe in one may be highly risky in another. It's only by understanding these differences that we can fully appreciate how technology shapes societies and how, in turn, technology is shaped by society. Now, let me end with a personal story. I first met Dr. Jasinov and I was a postdoc at Harvard. I was at that time a newly minted and naive PhD in engineering who believed in a universalist vision of technical progress. I wouldn't actually be able to say these words then. I can say that now. Conversations with Dr. Jasinov forced me to subtly alter my thinking and take into account the myriad human and cultural factors that shape knowledge production and use in societies. The legacy of this interaction remains with me till today. Thank you, Professor Jasinov, for being such an important influence in the lives of so many young scholars. And thank you again for sharing your wisdom with us today at the Vancouver Institute. Thanks.